Andrew Vax's work has exposed him to shocking stories. He's a lawyer in New York City, specializing in child abuse cases. Many of the children he represents are victims of physical abuse, incest, or pedophilia. Vax also writes crime fiction. His stories are informed by his encounters with the abusers he calls the maggots. The main character in Vax's novels is an orphan, ex-con, scam artist, and unlicensed private eye named Burke. Vax's third Burke novel has just been published by Knopf. It's called Blue Bell. Before writing fiction and starting his law career, Vax worked as a public health investigator, tracking the spread of venereal diseases, and he ran a maximum security institution for juvenile offenders. Vax's crusade against child abusers led him to start writing crime novels.
Well, I'd done a considerable amount of writing for professional journals and even for magazines about the same themes. And it became clear to me that if I wanted to reach the size audience that I believe needed to be reached with this material, I needed to find another format. And this was the only one that's really available to somebody who's not rich. I couldn't very well go out and make my own movies.
I want you to describe Burke, the main character in your novels.
Burke is a practicing criminal who's an urban survival expert and is good at only that, basically a failure at everything else. Formerly a violent criminal who would like to live nonviolently and still survive, and whose life problem is constantly being sucked back into violence.
But he's frequently violent on the side of the good guys.
I don't know, frequently. And Burke's not a white knight, and he's not anybody's idea of a contemporary hero, but he does have a hard spot in his heart for child molesters, and that does cause continuing problems in his life, yeah.
To get a sense of the setting of the book, and the setting is New York, I'd like you to do a short reading from the beginning of the book, which describes describes something of the of part of the neighborhood that this is set in.
Okay. Let's see. People have always lived down here. The neighborhood used to be a damned art colony. It produced more pottery than the whole Navajo Nation. The hippies and the artists thought the winos added just the right touch of realism to their lives. But the new occupants are the kind who get pre-orgasmic when you whisper investment banking, and they didn't much care for the local color. Locksmiths were riding the crest of a growth industry. The Superior Hotel entrance was around the corner on Chambers Street, with rooms extending all along West Broadway. Mine was on the top floor, facing out over the park. $75 a week bought me a swayback single bed and an iron frame, a ratty old easy chair worn down to the cotton padding on the arms, and a metal closet standing against the wall. The room was painted in some kind of neutral-colored stuff that was about half disinfectant. A heavy length of vinyl-wrapped chain stood against the wall, anchored at one end to U-bolts driven into the floor. The other end stood open, padlocked to nothing, waiting patiently. I hadn't gone for the optional TV at only $2 a day. Someone who had never lived in one might say the room looked like a prison cell. It didn't come close.
Yeah, and Burke, who's narrating there, used to be a convict.
Yeah.
He's an ex-con. Now, this is a guy who's a criminal who works against child molesters, but is not a licensed private investigator by any means. You work in the system as a lawyer working against child abuse. Do you see him as an alter ego in any way?
No, I really don't. I see him as a tour guide through a significant piece of hell, and I think that one has to be qualified to be a guide. I don't think that a tourist would be a good one to show people around.
Do you ever wish you could take the law into your hands the way he does?
Everybody wishes they could take the law into their hands once in a while. I don't think Burke's a particularly effective person and wouldn't want to emulate him.
One of his friends is someone who's nicknamed the Professor, and he speaks in rhymes, and he says, "Cutting up slime ain't no crime." What do you think of that attitude?
I think that's his attitude. I don't think it's an uncommon attitude among a class of criminals that seems to be disappearing. My contemporaries, people my age, had that attitude. I'm not so sure it's a contemporary attitude.
As part of your work now, do you have to go to the kinds of sex parlors and strip joints that so much of your book is set in?
I have to go a lot of places that I wouldn't choose to go if it were my own choice. Not too often a strip joint, not anywhere near as much as I did when I was working in other capacities, but certainly I have to go to places where children or pictures of children are bought and sold and trafficked in.
Burke, the main character in your book, says that there's no more outlaw code, that there's no rules for freaks. Do you think that things have changed in the criminal world, that the freaks that you're writing about are different than, say, the gangsters or the criminals of earlier times?
I don't think there's any question about it. I also think that the criminal subculture perception of child molesters has changed radically. It's a common treasured delusion of liberals that child molesters are very harshly dealt with in prison. And that's just not true. It would be impossible 20, 30 years ago to survive in prison if you were known to be an informant. That's not the case today either.
You know, I want to ask you something else about writing detective fiction.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of crime novels, it seems that the detective or the cop recognizes something of themselves in the criminal who they're tracking. And part of the tension in the novel comes from the sense of the criminal almost being the secret sharer of the cop or the detective. And I wonder if you ever feel you have that kind of relationship with the characters who you write about.
I don't know, because it's more a little more complex than that. In this book, of course, there is a relationship between a cop and a criminal. But that relationship is based on past conduct, and it ends up being, to some extent, betrayed during the book. I myself don't feel a relationship between characters so much as what the characters do. That's specifically what I would relate to.
You're really no prude in terms of sex or violence in the writing of your book. Do you ever think that that might work against you in court? Might that be a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's a common misperception that people will read a novel and assume that everything that's in the novel is a reflection of the author's particular individual lifestyle. But my work is very specialized, very hardcore work, and I haven't found any of this stuff impacting on it in any realistic way. People have read the books, and they'll say that they've read the books, and they like them or they hate them. But it doesn't seem to have influenced any verdicts that I can tell.
My guest is Andrew Vax, who is a lawyer in New York specializing in child abuse cases. He's also a crime novelist, and his new novel is titled Bluebell. It's just been published by Knopf. One of the things that you did before you became a lawyer was to direct a maximum security facility for juvenile offenders who were aggressive or violent. Were there any changes that you made in the facility while you ran it?
Yeah, there were the most dramatic changes possible.
What'd you do?
Well, I can sum it up for you very simply. When the prison was under control and running at least partly the way we wanted, there were no suicide attempts, there were no stabbings, there were no homosexual attacks. If you ask anybody who's run a maximum security institution, they'll tell you that in and of itself is remarkable.
What did you do to get those results?
That would take longer than this program, but essentially we explained very clearly and graphically to the prisoners that they were not going to run the institution, that we were, and that they could choose the level of violence necessary to make their behavior proper, from none to a lot, depending on how they behaved.
Did you feel that the offenders had been running it before, had been running the prison? Is it a prison? Is that the right word?
Yeah, it was okay. A prison, and the offenders were certainly running it.
Mm-hmm.
When we took it over, there had been an attempted rape of a staff member. There had been numerous escapes. There had been horrible violence. There had been a small core group of inmates that were clearly in charge and were calling all the shots.
So how did you take the control out of their hands?
In some cases, physically, and in some cases by changing the nonsensical subculture that existed. They'd run it on sort of this token economy system, like you might in a sheltered workshop, where you got points for certain kinds of conduct. And we found, of course, that the worst-behaved inmates had all the points for the best behavior because the staff were just frankly afraid of them.
So you got rid of that whole system?
And that whole staff, yeah.
How did working in a prison for juvenile offenders lead to your work with children who are victims of sexual abuse?
Well, many of the kids that were in there fit that category quite well. When I did sort of a half-baked, non-academic survey, I'd asked all the kids if they'd been abused, and they uniformly said no. And so I got one kid who'd come in there with half his face being scar tissue and cigarette butts burnt out on his arms, how he could say he hadn't been abused. He told me that his mother had chopped off his little brother's hand, so he figured that was abuse, and he hadn't been. It became pretty apparent to me, and then and now I'm absolutely certain of it, that there's no such thing as a biogenetic mutation that causes lifestyle criminality, that it's an environmental issue. And what I was living with was the hardcore precipitate from long-term chronic child abuse.
So you found that a lot of the prisoners had been the victims of child abuse?
Oh, yeah. Almost uniformly.
When you were working as the director of that prison, did it convince you that people who had become criminals could be redeemed, or did it convince you of the hopelessness of trying?
What it convinced me of was there's a direct correlation between the speed and the earliness with which you intervene and the result. The later you try, the worse your chance of success. And don't forget, even though I had a prison full of people who'd committed the worst crimes, homicides, rapes, armed robberies, they were young people, 16, 17, 18 years old. I would venture to say that those same people left in that same state at 35 would be close to unredeemable.
So was your idea to start working with children who were much younger before they got to the point of committing those crimes?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In order to make any kind of an impact, instead of reforming juvenile corrections, I was hoping to remove a significant number of the candidates for juvenile corrections.
Now, how does it work when you're a lawyer defending children? The child can't go and hire you.
No. Well, that depends, actually. I have been hired by teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you mean a small child, of course not. The way it works in New York State is this. The state recognizes there are three interests in a child abuse trial. There's the state interest, there's the accused's interest, and there's the child's interest. And so children are automatically given separate independent counsel in a child protective proceeding, and you're appointed by the court.
When you are appointed and you are representing a child, if they are the victim of sexual abuse, how do you get the child to tell you what happened?
It's generally not difficult, but most children speak through their behavior rather than through their words. I interviewed a 5-year-old girl who, was led into the room, and the social worker said, "This is your lawyer," and she climbed to my lap and grabbed my genitals. I didn't need to have a big diagnostic workup to figure out this child had been abused.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I don't work alone or independently. There's a team of people, including some very skilled clinical personnel, who can do the diagnostic interviews if they're required. So, and sometimes the evidence is so physically graphic that nobody needs further interviews.
This instance that you just mentioned where you invited a child on your lap and they grabbed your genitals,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that really shows what they'd been trained to do. Did you have a long talk with the child afterwards to explain that?
I mean,
how do you deal with that?
Well, the way I dealt with that was I'm describing something that happened the first time, and I was shocked and pulled the kid away and said, "What are you doing?" And the child looked at me and said, "You're a daddy, right? All daddies like that." And I tried my best to explain and saw that it was not an explanation that could be delivered in one sitting. And that child was referred to a very skillful therapist and is still in therapy even as we speak. It's been years.
When you're dealing with a young child, do they know the difference between a therapist and a lawyer and what the appropriate behavior is with each?
It depends on the age of the child, the child's intellect, the degree of abuse the child has suffered. Some certainly do.
Does it matter? I mean, should they behave differently with you, their lawyer, than they should with their therapist?
Well, only to the extent that we have different ends. If I'm preparing a child to testify, there's certain behavior and certain responses that I need that may be very different from what a therapist needs. A therapist might encourage a child to just go berserk, to just let it all out, to scream for an hour straight if that's what's needed. That wouldn't be what I'd need during testimony, for example. But we are all part of the same team, so the behavior doesn't need to be different. The one thing that's told the child all the time is you're safe with us, and as long as the child trusts that, the behavior tends to be about the same.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work as a lawyer and also about your fiction, but first we're going to take a short break. Andrew Vax is my guest. He's a lawyer in New York specializing in child abuse cases. He's also a crime novelist, and his third novel has just been published. It's called Bluebell. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Lawyer and crime novelist Andrew Vax is my guest. When you're representing a child, is it your job frequently to try to get them away from their parents?
Yes, it is.
What do you think of the alternatives to that? Would it be an institution for most of their children?
Certainly not any kid I represent, unless the kid is so melted down or so flagrantly psychotic that a foster home is impossible. I wouldn't ever go along with institutionalizing a child as an alternative to removal if the child's capable of even passively functioning in a foster care setting.
Do you get the feeling that in recent years there's been a rise in incest, child abuse, pedophilia?
No. I do think that because the media, which ends up being really the only force for social change in this country, having focused on it, there's a lot more reporting of what has always existed. I don't feel that the incidents themselves have increased.
What are some of the difficulties you feel you're up against as a lawyer trying to get convictions?
Well, one of the difficulties, of course, is judges, juries, citizens have trouble crediting their senses when they hear the accounts. They simply say this stuff can't be happening. And there's a denial mechanism, not unlike the denial mechanism that a victim goes through, that the public goes through. And that's one great difficulty. Another thing is that children don't make the world's greatest witnesses, especially very, very young children. And another difficulty is that much of the abuse doesn't leave a trail, such as physical abuse would leave. These are all things that have to be overcome.
Do you ever use unorthodox techniques to overcome those challenges?
I don't know. I think when we started, they were unorthodox. I don't think they're unorthodox anymore. Now it's become common for lawyers who represent kids to take the kid into the courtroom days before the trial starts and familiarize the child with the courtroom setting and even play some of the roles and use little tricks like telling the child that when a defense attorney screams and yells at you, that means he's afraid. And that's, of course, an energizing, empowering thing for the child who's previously been attacked. But I don't know what's left that's unorthodox. We use a system of, the only way to characterize it is voluntary informants. I get lots and lots of information from people that I've never met and probably never will meet. But this isn't so much a method as what's happened over the course of the years.
Have you also defended children who've been involved in kiddie porn rings?
I've never defended them because they haven't been attacked. Once I've defended their interests.
That's what I meant. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, yeah. The reason I make that distinction is I do defend children who are accused of crimes.
Right, right.
But I've never had to defend a kid who's been involved in kiddie porn, even when the kid's been an active recruiter, because it's pretty clear, even to the authorities, that this is pretty much Stockholm Syndrome, and a child that was coerced to the point where his mind was taken over. Nobody really wants to prosecute an 11-year-old who's recruiting 8-year-olds.
Right. What are some of the ways children are recruited into that trade?
Well, the easiest way is simply to appeal to what children like. I mean, every card-carrying pedophile has a nice collection of toys and video games and good food and lots of time to spend with a kid. Many of these kids no one spends time with at all. And someone who shows this kind of incredible, intense interest that really only a pedophile could show, this almost obsessive desire to be with the kid every minute and to lavish every bit of attention on him, is extremely seductive. And then there's a desensitization process, which usually begins with the gradual introduction of pornography. This is a way of showing the kid that everybody does these things, and they're perfectly okay and acceptable. And the pedophile picks carefully, and he'll make an initial probe. And unless he gets the right response, many of them will withdraw at that point.
Is there a syndrome of children who have been abused at home, running away from home to get away from their parents and then ending up in pornography?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, interview any prostitute out there under 16 years of age, and the odds are overwhelming that you'll find them running away from a horribly abusive environment. I remember one little girl that I took out of Times Square when I was taking her to the airport, and she had really been worked over very badly in her so-called profession. We were talking about running away, and I was talking, like about Huck Finn. I talked about running away for a sense of adventure, and she just didn't pay any attention. And I said, it seemed to me that people run away to get to a better place. And she looked me in the eye then and said, I did. To both.
Hmm.
So, and was quite clear that she'd return to the streets the second she got the opportunity.
You know, as I think I pointed out before, the characters in your novel are totally outside the system, except for a couple of cops in it. But the main character works totally outside the system. You work in the system as a lawyer. Are you satisfied with the results you get working through the system, or do you ever get really frustrated with the system and fantasize about working outside of it?
I actually never fantasize about working outside of it in a way that these characters do, because they're not really effective at what they do. People die, and individuals may get rescued or may not. But in terms of systemic change, it's not something these characters even contemplate. Anyone who doesn't get frustrated with the system isn't battling it as I am. But I don't feel I'm so much working within the system as working to change it. And it has changed.
What do you want to change within the system?
Oh, God. Unless you had a four-hour program, it would be impossible even to touch on it. But essentially, what I'd like to see is the system recognize that today's victim is tomorrow's predator, and that there's a direct causal connection between today's abused child and the beasts that will frighten us so much 10, 15 years from now. We don't have any national agenda about child abuse. We just have a lot of speeches. And if we invested even a portion of the money that we now invest in impossible dreams like interdicting narcotics on the coastline, we could see a really substantial change in the quality of life in this country.
So you'd like to see more, if you had your way, there wouldn't be confidentiality on child abuse cases?
There'd be limited confidentiality. I see no reason to keep the proceedings secret from the public, because the public largely believes that these cases don't happen. They believe people beat up their kids, but the idea of sexually abusing one's own child still is certainly foreign to most Americans.
I'm wondering if part of what you're trying to do is to shock the public into recognition of what's happening through your fiction. And I'm thinking there's a scene in your new novel where one character says to Burke, "Tell me the worst thing that you know."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, baby parts, that there's a whole black market in not only selling babies, but in taking some of the babies and kind of chopping them up for parts. So if a heart transplant is needed, you could sell the heart or the kidney.
Mm-hmm. Well, the goal is not simply to shock people, which I think in and of itself does nothing, but to make people angry. The American public is this great slumbering beast that's incredibly powerful, but sleeps most of the time. But when energized, it's an awesome force. I think simply shocking people is useless. I think if people don't feel that they can do something about it, they won't. There are many things that could be done. Just off the top of my head, in New York State, incest is the lowest class felony possible. It's an automatic probation-eligible offense. It's lumped, if you look in the penal law, right next to adultery. It shouldn't be so. Incest is rape by extortion, and should be penalized like any other rape. There shouldn't be immunity or special treatment for criminals who grow their own victims.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about scams, only because you seem to know so much about them in your book. You've got, really, I have to say, a great variety of scams. Is this just from being a resident of New York, or have you gone out of your way to research some of these scams?
I've not researched them. I've been exposed to them. I don't know how you'd research them. I mean, I don't know. I don't see them written down anyplace.
Right.
But...
Well, tell us about a couple of the mail-order scams that you have Burke doing.
Well, the essence of all Burke's scams are to sting people who can't sting back. So Burke would not do a mail-order scam where he was promising people land in Florida that he didn't possess. That'll last only a few weeks before the Attorney General moves in on you. What Burke does is target people who, for example, who collect kiddie pornography and not deliver it, and they can't hardly complain. Burke targets people who fancy themselves mercenaries, and so he sells them information on joining mercenary armies which don't exist. Again, you have a group of people that can't complain. That's the kind of work that he wants to do and the kind of work he'd rather stay with if he could.
Do you know people doing those scams?
I know of such scams being done.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Through pictures of you, I should preface this question by saying that you're speaking to us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. And so we are not in the same room together, but through pictures of you, I've seen that you wear an eye patch over one eye, and I guess you're blind in one eye. Some people prefer to use a glass eye or something like that, and I was wondering, if your choice of using a patch has anything to do with appearances. And I think what I mean by that is, since your work sometimes takes you to some pretty tough places, maybe you'd look more tough yourself with the eye patch.
Well, that's really wrong on both counts.
Okay.
I'll explain to you.
Please.
The first thing is, I'm not blind in the eye. The eye is badly damaged, and it the muscle wall between the two eyes has been torn and restitched numerous times. So it wouldn't work binocularly. The eye is patched off because if light hits it, I get a strobing effect, so I'm constantly nauseous. However, it does work enough. It's not correctable so that I could ever read with it or drive a car. But it does work enough so that it would be insane to destroy it. It's a valuable spare part, since I've only got one left.
I see.
And the second thing is that an eye patch may look, I don't know, tough in a picture, but the places I have to work, any impediment is more likely to get people to attack you, not less.
Right, because people are watching for your vulnerabilities.
Sure.
And looking to take advantage of them.
Sure.
Right. Okay, well, I hope you didn't mind me asking you.
No, not at all. I mean, I understand that there could be a lot of confusion about it, and it's not normally something I discuss, but the patch has got a functional purpose, and I've had surgery on my face numerous times. I'm not giving up, and I hope someday I don't have to wear the damn thing anymore.
Good, yeah, that'd be great. Well, listen, thank you very, very much for talking with us about your writing and about your work as a lawyer. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Vax has been my guest, and he's a lawyer who specializes in child abuse cases working in New York City. He's also a crime novelist, and his new novel, Bluebell, has just been published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.